don't show up to work on construction sites, in healthcare services, auxiliary services that all of us rely on. People will not go to work. What does that mean? That means a hit on our economy. I don't know if the White House administration has really thought about that.
L.A. County Supervisor Hilda Solis this morning talking about the planned ICE raids this weekend. Starting Sunday, the Trump administration is expected to round up around 2,000 undocumented immigrants in at least 10 major cities. That includes L.A. It says it's pursuing immigrants with outstanding deportation orders and those who've missed court appearances. President Trump previously announced these raids in June, then postponed them with little warning. Here to tell us more about this is Linda Lopez, head of the L.A. Mayor's Office of Immigrant Affairs. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
And Michael Kaufman, senior staff attorney for the ACLU of Southern California. Thanks for joining with us.
Hi, good to be here.
So, Linda, let's start with you. How is the city preparing for these expected raids?
Well, first of all, Mayor Garcetti has reaffirmed that the city will not, and LAPD will not participate or assist in civil immigration enforcement. And what we've been doing is a number of things to proactively engage with the community so that they know that we're on their side. One of the things that we've already been doing is conducting Know Your Rights workshops with some of our local nonprofit partners. Secondly, we're also going to have the availability of resources through our 311 system, so that anybody that needs information or resources to legal service providers or basic Know Your Rights information can go to 311, and we will be responsive as well for our community. And the last thing I would say is that we have been creating a number of different resources, including a community resource guide for individuals who need to know more information on their own rights and also where to go for resources.
What rights does an undocumented immigrant have in this situation?
Well, so the rights that immigrants have are clear. Number one, the rights include the right to remain silent. Immigrants should know that they don't need to open their door if somebody knocks on it. So, for example, if an ICE agent doesn't have a warrant signed by a judge, they also have the right to speak to a lawyer before signing any documents or speaking to law enforcement. And so what we're doing at the city is to provide additional assistance in, for example, finding an attorney if they need it, and to call our 311 system through our LA Justice Fund and offer that legal support.
Michael, the ACLU has filed a lawsuit, did it yesterday, to protect those threatened from this weekend's deportation or expected deportation raids. What is the legal argument there behind the lawsuit?
Yeah, so I think the background here is important for people to understand. Since 2014, the government has adopted specialized procedures for families seeking asylum in the U.S. These are people primarily from Central America. And in most cases, the government has expedited the processing of their cases in what's known as rocket dockets in ways that have made it virtually impossible for people to show up for their hearings, much less prepare for their cases. So, for example, people may be set for a hearing in Texas, even though they've moved to Seattle and have no readily available means to travel on short notice. The government has also acknowledged that it has massive problems with its notice system for court hearings. So we know that in thousands of cases, the government has mailed notices to incorrect addresses. They've sent notices with no date or time on them. And they've set a court hearing for dates when there's no hearings being held at all, including on weekends when the immigration courts aren't even open. So as a result of, for the last 5 years, immigration judges have issued what's known as in absentia order, removal orders for people who don't show up for scheduled hearings, for tens of thousands of unrepresented families and their children who really never had a fair opportunity to appear in court.
But so how sympathetic, though, would a judge be to that argument? I mean, at the end of the day, as the Trump administration says, they are targeting people who did miss their court appointments, who did have outstanding deportation orders. If that was the case, I mean, how sympathetic is the legal system going to be to that argument?
Well, this what we're talking about is really a basic and core due process protection that before the government takes the extreme measure of deporting someone from the country, potentially separating families, and also reporting people who are claiming that they may face torture and other kinds of harm in their countries where they come from, before they take those drastic steps, we simply need to have a process in place to make sure that the notice they received was effective, that they had an adequate opportunity to come to court and make their case. And let's let the process play out. The people who have strong claims and the right to remain here can, and those that don't won't prevail. But what we have right now is an extraordinarily defective system where people aren't getting notice, aren't getting that basic opportunity to be heard.
Linda, what are the chances that these planned raids will actually happen? As we said earlier, the Trump administration had initially sort of made the announcement that they were going to have these raids back in June, and then he abruptly seemed to call them off, saying that he wanted to give Congress more time to fix what he sees as a broken asylum process.
Yeah, that's a really, I think, great question. You know, we've been working locally with our local law enforcement to essentially find out, you know, more information on these anticipated raids for Sunday. So, you know, at this point in time, you know, we don't know for certain whether that's actually going to happen. But the other thing I would mention is that when you think about sort of the capacity for ICE to actually do these raids starting on Sunday, we're talking about, you know, 400 to 500 agents in Southern California who would essentially be responsible for carrying out these raids. And so I think that from a capacity perspective, you know, unlike what the president had said, that it's about 1 million people that would be targeted initially, we're down to approximately, you know, for the last raid that was announced, 2,000 or so individuals. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of conversation right now about the imminent threat of having these raids, but it's still, you know, to be determined whether it's an absolute certainty.
And how does this compare to how immigration raids were done under previous administrations? Is it common for the president or ICE to publicize the fact that they may be planning a raid on a specific day?
So I think that one of the distinctions here, I think that sort of differs from the past, is that now we're essentially receiving, you know, these advance notices through different tweets and different things from the administration. And so, for example, when we think about our local law enforcement with respect to our own sort of ICE officials here locally, typically what ends up happening is that we do get some sort of pre-advance notice, if you will, from local ICE local ICE officers. But in this case, I think that what's happening is it's different in the sense that now, you know, there is sort of a more advanced notice, if you will, via these different media sources and outlets that the administration has used. So I think it's a little different compared to, you know, what happened during the Obama administration.
And Linda, or to Michael, doesn't this also seem to put ICE agents themselves in a rather precarious situation? If, you know, an undocumented immigrant has advance notice that they may be ordered deported and they feel that they would do anything to avoid that, I mean, does that not put the agents themselves in somewhat of a dangerous situation potentially?
Well, I think as Linda was alluding to, I think part of the purpose from this administration and from ICE and announcing these raids in advance is really to intentionally create fear and create chaos in immigrant communities by announcing their plans to target families for deportation. Look, these are not dangerous people. These are families that are here trying to seek protection in the United States and trying to make way for themselves. And what the administration has done by continuing to announce these raids, put them in the newspapers, is create this culture of fear to sort of terrorize these communities. And as this administration has done time and time again, make life for them as painful as possible when all they're seeking to do is vindicate rights that they have under the United States laws to seek protection here.
Michael Kaufman, senior staff attorney with the ACLU of Southern California, and Linda Lopez, head of the LA Mayor's Office of Immigrant Affairs. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Back in January, I headed to Washington, D.C. to follow two of California's freshman Democrats during their very first week as Congresswomen. The two Katies, Katie Hill from Santa Clarita and Katie Porter from Irvine. Earlier this week, we heard from Hill, so today we'll hear from Porter. She ousted longtime Republican incumbent Mimi Walters in a very close midterm race that took more than a week to finalize. Despite her narrow victory, Porter is also one of the very first Democrats from a swing district to call for President Trump to be impeached. I spoke with Congresswoman Porter earlier.
So you've been in Congress now for a little over 6 months. What's been the biggest adjustment you've had to make in terms of sort of what you thought the job was going to be like and how it actually ended up being like?
For me, the biggest challenge is trying to be a bi-coastal representative. My children and I love living in Orange County. I come home every weekend, and I'd like to have as much time in the district to be hearing the voices of families here as I do in Washington. Sometimes it feels like I spend a little bit more time in Washington, and of course the travel time, which is about 18 to 20 hours a week. I'm not going to lie to my constituents. I don't really enjoy the airplane part of the job.
Yeah. I couldn't blame you. How have you and your family been adjusting to this? I know this was a big kind of topic of conversation. You were a single mother, three young kids. How have you been adjusting to that bi-coastal lifestyle?
My kids are doing terrific. I think they find my being in Congress much less stressful than the campaign. There's some certainty about what's happening. I go to work. I work in Washington. They know what I'm doing. I think they're doing really well. I just made three camp drop-offs. And here in a couple hours, I'll make three camp pickups. So anytime you're succeeding in getting everybody to their camp on time with a lunch, with a swimsuit, with sunscreen, I think you're having a great day.
And, you know, back to the job, was there any part of the job where you sort of thought, yep, this is exactly what I thought it was going to be like being a representative in Congress?
For me, two things are really my favorite parts of the job and the parts that I think are most consistent with how I think the job should be done. One of those is hearings. So I'm on the Financial Services Committee. We have a lot of great witnesses who've come in, the head of the Federal Reserve, the director of the CFPB, some of the leaders of the nation's largest banks, community advocates. And I really think those hearings are not an opportunity for me to hear myself talk or even for me to hear from the witnesses. They're really an opportunity for the American public to hear what the witnesses have to say. So being able to ask questions that draw the witness out, that help create a national dialogue about how our economy should be working and where it may be falling short, that's been incredibly satisfying. My second other favorite part of the job is I absolutely love doing town halls here in the 45th District. I've done six of them already. Just getting to hear from people about how they're thinking about things, what their perspective is, what the concerns are in their lives, that is an incredibly rewarding part of the job for me.
So that brings me to kind of my next question. I mean, what has it been like working in this era of hyper-divided government? I mean, the House, under Democratic control, has passed bills to lower drug prices, protect pre-existing conditions, protect Dreamers, but they go nowhere. I mean, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell likes to refer to himself as the Grim Reaper of the legislation that you guys are passing.
So it's very frustrating, frankly, to go and to pass some of these bills, to know that they would help families in the 45th District and to not see them going forward. But it's absolutely not an excuse for us to stop doing our jobs. If things are hard, the solution is to try harder. It's not to give up. And so I think we have to keep making our case to the American public, not just here in Orange County, but around the country, that these are important bills and that they have the broad support of Democrats, Republicans, and independents. A couple great examples I would give to you are in places where I had amendments that I'm really proud of are the gun violence prevention bills that we passed, as well as the Violence Against Women Authorization Act. These are incredibly important bills, and they have the support of the American people.
But given that these bills are stalled, I mean, what do you think the Democratic Party has accomplished? If you say that there needs to be an effort to try harder, I mean, what's missing?
So I think there's a multiple things that Congress does. I mean, some of it is legislative, and we are dependent on the Senate and ultimately on the president to sign bills into law. But when we send good bills forward, we are advancing the agenda. We are helping to lay the groundwork for what we can accomplish, hopefully when we have a more cooperative Senate in 2020. And this oversight work and this work in hearings is also a big part of what we do in Congress. And then, frankly, all the community work that I do, listening to groups, meeting with them, fighting waiting for additional appropriations. So to give you one example, we just passed an appropriations bill. I had an amendment that would give more resources to the CASA program, the Court-Appointed Special Advocate Program, which helps represent and represents children who are in situations where they are facing guardianship proceedings, maybe facing dealing with child abuse situations. And so that appropriations bill is going to pass the Senate, and it is going to make a real difference in people's lives. I did the exact same thing, fighting for an appropriations amendment with regard to the testing of rape kits. We have a huge backlog in addressing rape kits, and so I was able to direct additional funding so that we can process those rape kits and help get those victims the justice that they deserve.
So much of the Democratic agenda has been overshadowed by the conversation around impeachment, and you recently came out in favor of opening impeachment investigations into President Trump. You were one of the first freshmen who flipped a Republican district to do this. You know, what went into that decision? Why is that where you ultimately come down?
The Mueller report is quite clear. Mr. Mueller found substantial evidence of at least 4 counts and up to 10 counts of obstruction of justice. And for the president, who's in charge of safeguarding our democracy, to have engaged in obstruction of justice multiple times is an incredibly serious charge. So I didn't come to Congress to impeach the president, but I'm also not going to shy away from doing my duty and from holding the Trump administration accountable. That's what Orange County families sent me to Congress to do.
I want to talk a little bit. You said doing your duty. The most recent polls from Gallup show that the majority of Americans still do not think that President Trump should be impeached. And I think there was some recent polling out of your district specifically that puts those numbers even higher. You're already facing a number of Republican challengers for 2020. Do you think you're putting your own seat at risk by coming out in favor of impeachment?
I have a duty to do what I think is right for the people of the 45th Congressional District and for the people of this country. And that's how I think about my job. I understand that, you know, some people may be guided by polls. Our president certainly is a president who cares very much about the daily public opinion. But I really try to think about what's right for the long term. And I think anybody who's seen the hard work that I've been doing in congressional hearings, holding folks like Ben Carson accountable, people who've seen the appropriations I've been fighting for to help Orange County families, they'll see that I'm doing my entire job, and that while impeachment is a decision that I've made, I feel like I have a duty to be honest with my constituents about where my thinking is. But impeachment is by no means the main reason I went to Congress, and it's certainly not the most prevalent thing that I'm doing on a daily basis.
Do you think Speaker Pelosi and other Democratic Party leaders are making a mistake then by not pushing more for impeachment?
We're having a robust conversation in Congress. I will tell you that my colleagues and I do talk about both impeachment and these other substantive issues like prescription drug pricing and what's the best way forward. I think that conversation and that debate, that dialogue, is what democracy looks like. And to the extent that we're not all in agreement yet, that's also part of democracy. And so I personally have made up my mind, but I have a lot of tolerance, a lot of patience for my colleagues as they have a chance to talk to their constituents, as they have a chance to read the Mueller report. I think this is a process that is going to take time, and it's appropriate that it takes time.
As you yourself start looking to your reelection bid in 2020, what will you tell voters who might be on the fence about reelecting you? Like I said earlier, you Republicans are targeting your district. You are seen as vulnerable. And Republicans do still hold a slight edge, I think, in terms of voter registration numbers in your district.
Look, I was very clear when I ran that I was not running to represent the Democrats in Orange County. I was representing the families in Orange County. And that's what I always talk about, because that's really who I think about. This is a mixed area. We have people who have political views ranging from very progressive to quite conservative. And my job is to try to do what's best for the collective whole. And so I think when I start running on the issues that I've been working on, and I can show the bipartisan bills that I've introduced to repeal the harmful SALT tax deductions that hit Orange County families really hard, to promote better mental health care and better access to mental health care, to bring down the cost of prescription drugs. That's what I'm going to be running on, because that's what I've been doing in Congress.
And finally, speaking of 2020, have you decided who you'll be backing in the races? There's been some speculation as to why you haven't come out in favor of Elizabeth Warren, who's been described as a mentor of yours.
Well, so both Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris are wonderful people in my life. I think of them both as friends, as colleagues, as mentors, as people that I admire. And we have a real opportunity in California with this earlier primary coming up in March 3rd. Californians are going to have the chance to hear from some of these candidates, to meet some of these candidates. I want my constituents to make up their own mind about the best candidate for president. And I feel like my job is to open up those opportunities, to encourage them to get out there and to listen. It's not to tell them who to vote for.
But is it fair to say that your vote will be for one of those two women and not Joe Biden, who is seen as the party favorite?
One of those two women, or potentially, depending on how things play out, both of those two women will absolutely earn my vote. I think very, very highly of both of them. But I'm pleased that we have a strong field. To be clear, I thought during the debates, a number of candidates raised very, very good points. I thought Cory Booker raised some good points. I thought Joe Biden raised some good points. So having a strong Democratic field is an advantage. It's not something we should be afraid of.
Congresswoman Porter, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
That was Orange County Democratic Congresswoman Katie Porter.
Coming up, from Amazon to nursing school, why the online retail behemoth is spending hundreds of millions of dollars to return to retrain a full third of its workforce. That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Michelle Aloy, in for Madeline Brand. Amazon says it's spending $700 million to retrain a third of its U.S. workforce for new jobs. In some cases, jobs Amazon doesn't even offer. The online retail giant says it will offer optional retraining classes for employees to learn nursing skills or how to work on airplanes. That's in addition to preparing workers for more advanced jobs within Amazon, like software engineering and IT support. AT&T, Walmart, and JP Morgan Chase have all launched similar programs to help their employees prepare for a changing job market. Here to tell me more on this is Chip Cutter. He reports on workplace issues for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Chip, how is Amazon's job retraining program going to work?
Well, this is going to happen over a period of years, about 6 years. Amazon is trying to retrain 100,000 employees, so that is about a third of its U.S. workforce. And this is a voluntary program for employees. But the company is responding to both a tight job market and the real reality that jobs are going to change because of technology. What you do in your job will shift as technology shifts.
So you said 100,000 potential employees, but that it's voluntary. Is there any indication that they are going to get that many people to sign up for these retraining programs?
Well, you know, that is still an open question. The company thinks, employees will respond pretty enthusiastically to this. And it really offers a chance for employees to take their career in a different direction. So say you work at one of the company's corporate offices in a non-technical role. You could then take courses to become an entry-level software engineer. This could take you years. But say, for example, you're buying merchandise for Amazon right now. This job might have more automation in it in the future. And so Amazon says you may benefit from learning software engineering skills. Likewise, if you're already an engineer, you can then take courses from 400 Amazon instructors, some of them former university professors, to learn machine learning skills, kind of more advanced AI machine learning knowledge. So you can see that these jobs are shifting. Amazon really thinks its employees do need to kind of evolve as jobs do change.
So this breaks down to about $7,000 per employee. How does that compare to the price breakdown per employee that other big companies see when they're starting similar programs?
Right. It's about ends up being about $1,200 a year through 2025. That is more than the average of large employers who were surveyed by an industry group last year who reported spending on average of about $500 per worker on training in 2017. So it is a little bit more here. This is certainly one of the biggest retraining programs that's been announced across the U.S. But I do think it's important to mention that retraining programs can be pretty difficult. Not all employees have the kind of resources or kind of the abilities to shift in different roles. They may get into a program, say learning to become a software engineer, and decide it is not for them. So it's uncertain how all of these programs kind of will evolve.
Has Amazon broken down how many of its jobs they anticipate being eliminated by automation in the future?
Amazon has not. And when I spoke with a top executive, he made the case that he certainly sees a need for humans throughout the company, sees the need for that 5 years from now. But he does, for example, think technical skills will be required of more jobs that may not even seem technical right now. So he gave the example in some of the company's fulfillment centers, and I think there's about a half dozen of those just in the Southern California area alone. He gave the example that you're going to need more folks who are able to kind of fix the machines that are in these facilities. So part of this retraining program that Amazon has announced is a program to help people become IT support technicians. So you're there on the ground able to fix the thermal printers, the machines, the different devices that help to kind of sort packages and get shipments on their way. So this executive made the case that he thinks we'll see more fulfillment centers, more data centers. So you need people able to fix the machines inside of them.
I'm also interested in this other aspect, though, of Amazon training their workers for jobs outside of Amazon. I mean, it sounds like they're potentially looking at training some people to go to nursing school or train them to work on airplanes. How does that compare to what other companies have done, and what is the logic behind that?
Well, you would think of it kind of the similarities might be in a tuition reimbursement program in other companies, which is somewhat common across corporate America. But I think here the rationale would be that it helps Amazon keep workers longer. So Amazon will say it wants to help its employees gain new skills. But a number of labor experts I've spoken with said this also helps them to retain their existing workforce longer. So if I'm studying to become a nurse, I may keep working at that fulfillment center for longer, given that I'm taking these classes that will help me transition my career. So that probably is the benefit to them. It creates more stability. It helps to kind of reduce the cost of hiring new employees, retraining them. All of that can be expensive. And so I think this will have a real benefit of retention for them, one reason they're trying to do this.
I also wonder, though, I mean, if there's a small town somewhere in the central United States that relies heavily on the labor of an Amazon factory, an Amazon workplace, and if there is a sense of, I guess, corporate responsibility to ensure that there remain jobs in these smaller towns where Amazon might have a distribution center that might go away. I mean, certainly we've seen this with store closings, Walmart closing stores in small towns, and it's devastated economies. And is Amazon thinking at all about that in this calculation as well?
Well, it's hard to say. They certainly, the company wants to be seen as a good employer, as a good corporate citizen. But the company, of course, has come under intense scrutiny for its conditions at its warehouses and its workplace practices from lawmakers like Bernie Sanders and others. So I do think the company. Is embarking on these retraining efforts in part to help employees to kind of keep them employed, to kind of shift them into different roles. One expert I spoke with yesterday said that these programs can oftentimes work as almost a way to prevent layoffs. You shift people into different roles before those jobs become obsolete. So it's unclear how much that's part of Amazon's calculus here, but I do think it's an interesting component that, you know, if you're working in an hourly position in a fulfillment center now, perhaps you get retrained to be one of these IT support specialists, able to do something else, or you get retrained to work in a data center. So I think that can provide a benefit for workers worried about kind of the state of their jobs.
Has there been any pushback to this plan?
There has. There's been kind of immediate pushback by one of the unions that is looking to organize Amazon workers. This is the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union. And the group said yesterday that Amazon's adoption of automation would lead to, quote, massive job losses that could cripple our entire economy. So you've seen a pushback from this, and you've certainly, I think, seen a number of groups kind of skeptical about what Amazon is really doing here. The union, for example, called this a PR stunt.
What does this say about this era of corporate responsibility? You know, you have these giant behemoths that employ so many people, and entire global economies are dependent on which way these companies are deciding to sort of move their workforce. I guess, is it cheaper to train your current workforce for a totally different job, either to pay for nursing school or to train them to be IT specialists within the company? I mean, why not just kind of up and move somewhere where you can find demand for those jobs?
Well, I think that is the big question across corporate America right now. A number of companies are assessing whether it's cheaper to train their current workers or to just lay them off in favor of hiring new hires who have the needed skills. And that's been a response from a number of companies. We've seen GM, for example, lay off workers at the same time noting that it needs people with new skills. So I think that remains a question across corporate America. Can we build our workforce that we need from our existing staff, or do we need to go outside and find them? I think the tight labor market that we have right now with historically low unemployment has led many employers to say it might be better to kind of train our existing workforce who already understands our culture, knows the company, help them train into different roles. So we think that's why we see a number of companies embarking on retraining efforts, just knowing that it is so difficult to hire right now.
Chip Cutter, reporter covering workplace issues for the Wall Street Journal. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, California just became the first state to ban discrimination based on natural hairstyles like afros and braids.
Women, as they enter into professional workplaces, as they strive to be upwardly mobile, end up running up against grooming policies and stereotypes that disproportionately affect them.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Michelle Aloy, filling in for Madeline Brand. California is now the first state to ban racial discrimination based on natural hairstyles like afros, braids, and cornrows. Governor Gavin Newsom last week signed the Crown Act. That stands for Creating a Respectful and Open Workplace for Natural Hair. And it prevents employers and schools from enforcing grooming policies that would disproportionately affect people of color. Here to tell us more about this new law and hair discrimination is Chelsea Johnson. She's a sociologist that studies Black identity and hair. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
So, Chelsea, this is radio, so I have to say for the listeners, you are a Black woman. What are the things that you've experienced?
So, growing up from about 2 or 3 years old, my mom chemically relaxed my hair. So I had no idea what my hair texture looked like. All of the Black women around me wore their hair straight. It was part of getting ready to go to church or picture day. But it wasn't until I went to Spelman, which is a historically Black college for women in Atlanta. And around that time, the natural hair movement was starting to kick off. This was like around 2008, after Chris Rock's Good Hair came out. And I sort of just started to see what would it look like if I didn't relax my hair. And so I met my hair texture for the very first time at age 20.
So as someone who studies this, how is hair in particular tied to Black identity?
Hair is tied to Black identity dating back to the transatlantic slave trade, where coming to the New World as slaves, hair texture was one of the most visible signifiers of African ancestry next to skin color. And so it was used to distinguish between the slave class and the enslaved people. If you look at images of like Aunt Jemima on a pancake box and she's got her hair tied up in a handkerchief, you start to see how hair is really becomes a bar of measuring somebody who is enslaved or somebody who is subservient and somebody who is master. And so during Jim Crow era, as more Black women were entering into the workforce, many women decided to straighten their hair in order to de-emphasize the differences between their white colleagues and themselves, in order to say like, hey, I'm just like you. I'm not somebody who is biologically or culturally different from you. So from then on, most Black women, especially middle-class Black women, straightened their hair. So there are many cultural hairstyles like braids and cornrows and dreadlocks, but also hair straightening has a really strong history in the Black community as well.
So California already has a law that prevents discrimination based on race. So why do you think extending legal protections to certain specific traits that are tied to race is important and necessary beyond just the sort of general law that you can't discriminate based on race?
So something that the Crown Act does that extends protections that already existed was to protect natural hairstyles. So in the past, discrimination was based on things that you can't change. So your skin color or your hair texture, this is something that you can't change. And so women and men should be protected by that. But hairstyles is something different. The thought has been, like, if you can change it, why shouldn't you? So grooming policies are really a way of sort of disciplining all women, but especially women of African descent, into a particular style, and treating them with natural hair as unprofessional, as messy, as wild. Those are the sorts of adjectives and language that are used to describe natural hairstyles. So it's really shifting and expanding the definition from, like, biological difference to cultural difference.
And so I want to play a clip of tape from California Senator Holly Mitchell. She's the one who sponsored the bill. Here she is talking about it.
Eurocentric standards of beauty have established the very underpinnings of what was acceptable and attractive in the media, in academic settings, and in the workplace. And so even though African Americans were no longer explicitly excluded from the workplace, Black features and mannerisms remained unacceptable and, quote, unprofessional.
So again, as somebody who's an expert in this area, like, what do you hear there that Senator Holly Mitchell saying that stands out to you?
What I'm hearing is that women, as they enter into professional workplaces, as they strive to be upwardly mobile, end up running up against grooming policies and stereotypes that disproportionately affect them. So this isn't just hair, but the conversations that we've had about African American vernacular English or certain styles of dress also disproportionately disadvantage people of color and people who are not white. So what I'm hearing there is that, yes, you might read a law and it doesn't say race anywhere, but oftentimes these things are coded and they're more implicit, or they're what we call microaggressions, or implicit ways of calling up race, like a colorblind racism, that continue to exclude women, particularly Black women, but also Black people, without ever even saying race. So what the Crown Act does is make that explicit, make the implicit explicit, and grant women the right to bear grievances.
So Mitchell also says that part of the intent of her bill here was to dispel myths about Black hair. And what are some of those myths that she's talking about?
Yeah, so a lot of those myths are kind of conjured in the sorts of adjectives that people use when they talk about natural hair, that it's wild, that it's unkempt, that because it doesn't lay straight or flat or smooth, that means somebody didn't groom themselves. When in fact, taking care of natural hair is really, really labor intensive. If you walk into like a Black beauty supply store, you will see so many different sorts of tools and technologies and products. And just because it doesn't look like somebody of European descent, doesn't mean that it didn't take work to achieve that look, and doesn't mean that it doesn't serve a purpose. So what protective hairstyles really mean are protecting your hair from having to do it every single day, because it takes a lot of care to do natural hair. To braid it up in intricate styles takes work and it takes money, and that should be acknowledged and respected.
So, you know, at the end of the day, do you think this law has the kind of teeth to be, you know, truly enforceable? Because, you know, certainly when employers are making hiring decisions, they don't outright tell people that they're not being hired because they're a woman or they're Muslim or they're wearing braids, even though that really may be what's playing into a hiring decision. So how could somebody, you know, truly use this law if they, you know, found the need to?
Yeah, you know, I think that's going to be tough. I really do, to be honest with you. So the case that really inspired the law was a woman in Alabama from 2010, where the hiring manager actually explicitly called her dreadlocks messy. So there are some cases where it is really blatant, and in those cases, I think the law will work the best. But what I think the real work that this law will do is through the conversation that we're having now. By giving information and giving visibility to what it means to be a Black woman in a world where you're often the only. And I think just that understanding and that greater conversation and discussion outside of Black women's own communities, because we talk about this all the time and have been for centuries. The fact that we're having this conversation on Press Play, I think, gives the bill, maybe not teeth, but gives it more impact.
Chelsea Johnson, she's a sociologist looking at the intersection of hair and Black identity at USC. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Coming up, the husbands are here to break down this week's movie releases. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Michelle Alloy, in for Madeline Brand. It's Friday. The weekend is near. It's going to be a hot one, and maybe you'll want to find some sanctuary in a highly air-conditioned place. So let's talk about the new movies opening this weekend. Alonzo Duralde and Dave White are here to tell us what to see. Both review for The Wrap and host the podcast Linoleum Knife. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there.
So let's start with The Farewell. This is a drama/comedy starring Awkwafina and directed by Lulu Wong.
What's wrong, Dad? Please tell me.
Manette is dying.
She doesn't know. So you can't say anything. The family thinks it's better not to tell her.
Why is that better? Chinese people have saying, when people get cancer, they die.
Right, Alonzo, so we talked about this movie with director Lulu Wong this week. Did you guys like it?
Very much.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. No, I think this is a gorgeous film. It's going to surprise people who think of Awkwafina as strictly a comedy person or even a rapper. This is a really beautiful performance. I mean, there is wit and humor to it, but it's also very poignant and dramatic. This is like a real breakthrough for her. Also for director Lulu Wong, it's not her first feature, but I think this is the one that's really going to be a breakthrough for her.
So I was going to ask, how is Awkwafina in this? Because it seems like, you know, we know her as this big, brash kind of, you know, off the wall personality in films.
My introduction to Awkwafina several years ago was watching her on YouTube rapping with Margaret Cho about their vaginas. And so you don't understand the progress of a career and where, you know, you don't know everything about a person from something like that.
Right. And there is that thing of, you know, every clown wants to play Hamlet, and, you know, comedians will often tackle these kinds of roles. But she is so organically placed here. She feels like a part of this family. You buy her as this woman who is in her early 30s and still trying to figure out what her life is, but has this really deep relationship with her grandmother in China, who she talks to on the phone every day. And so when she finds out that the grandmother is dying, she is both appalled at the fact that the family isn't telling her about it, but also drops everything, even though she is, you know, not in the greatest financial straits, to just like, hey, I'm going to travel to China.
Right.
But she goes with everybody else for this fake wedding that's been created as an excuse for everybody to see the grandmother for one last time.
She's wonderful in this. She is an absolutely different Awkwafina than the person you know. And she is absolutely a sort of calling card performance. Like,
this is a Tom Hanks in
big
moment.
I'm not just a comic person. I can do pretty much anything.
So this is even more of a breakout role for her than, say, Crazy Rich Asians, where she kind of stole the show.
No question.
Well, I think these two films together really show you what she can do.
And Ocean's 8.
She is really funny, and in fact, she's quite funny in this film. But it's in a much more muted, you know, personal, emotional way.
All right, let's move on to our next film. This is Crawl. It's a thriller where a Florida hurricane meets an alligator, or alligators.
The state of Florida has issued a Category 5 hurricane warning. All residents must evacuate immediately. Grab your families, your loved ones. Get out.
Dad!
We won't be able to come for you.
Dad!
All right, Dave, this took me back to grade school sleepovers watching the 1997 classic Anaconda.
Yes. This one stars Kaia Scodelario as a competitive swimmer who, against all better Floridian judgment, runs back to her father's house to check on him as a Category 5 hurricane is bearing down. And with it come... what is a group of alligators called?
Of alligators?
A correlation?
A Mar-a-Lago of alligators? Is that what happens? There's 20 of them, and two of them have gotten inside the house.
Wait, there's 20 of them? Because the, when I the many. Trailer, there was
there
just
are
the
enough
one.
Alligators in this movie to eat all the hurricane looters and all the hurricane cops.
That's not alligators.
And they get...
They're very equal opportunity that way.
Yes, but they especially want to eat this father and daughter. And so they go into the house. The house is already partially underwater. And the father and daughter are trapped under the house. They have to escape. And the entire film is just trying to not get their faces bitten off. And it's delightful and stupid and gory. It's what you want it to be.
Is there a larger metaphor here for, like, climate change
you
or
would
anything?
Think perhaps, but Florida, when you talk about hurricanes in Florida, you might talk about climate change.
That's not a change from anything.
You should, yeah. But it's not like Florida's not had hurricanes until now, you know. So, no, they don't ever say anything about climate change, but... it's climate change.
You know, if you like The Shallows and you like 47 Meters Down, this is another sort of like woman against nature kind of thriller, and it's effective. It's all hacky jump scares, but it totally worked for me. And before people start bombarding you with tweets and emails, it's A Congregation.
Oh, okay. A Congregation.
Yes. I like mine better.
Okay. Well,
I think it should be a Mar-a-Lago from now on.
Yeah, I think, like, let's lobby for the official name change there. This is directed by Alexandra Asha. He directed the 2006 The Hills Have Eyes. So compared to that, how gruesome is Crawl? You mentioned that it was kind of gory.
It's quite gory because they don't skimp on alligators eating people.
But a lot of it happens in
just
long
limbs
shots.
In the water.
Yeah.
It's not nearly as gory as Aja's Piranha 3D.
Oh,
no, which... that's like the high bar.
Yeah,
like that's right in your face.
I'd say I saw that. That one. That sounds too.
Piranha 3D is great. Insane in a wonderful way. This is a little less.
Yeah,
yeah.
All right, let's end on a lighter note here. Final film, Stuber. It's a comedy starring Dave Bautista and Kumail Nanjiani.
Please be a five-star ride.
Hey! Uber?
Yeah. Be cool, be nice.
I'm Stu. How do you do?
Compton. I'm LAPD. Let's go.
Or do you have a more specific address?
Compton!
Stop yelling, neighborhoods. That's not how Uber works.
All right, Alonzo. So Kumail is an Uber driver here. What is the plot beyond that?
Okay. So Dave Bautista is a cop. Who has,
so we know where this is going.
Who has just had LASIK and cannot drive himself. And of course, it is that very day that his nemesis drug kingpin who killed his partner, played by Iko Uwais of The Raid, who is criminally underused here, got a big drop happening. So he hijacks this Uber driver basically to take him all over town to try and fix the big solve the case, whatever they do. I don't know.
Catch the bad guy.
Here's right. The thing. I think Dave Bautista is terrific in the Guardian movies and in Blade Runner 2049. Kumail Nanjiani, super talented as a performer and as a writer. Director Michael Dowse previously did Goon and What If, two movies I really like. This is one of the worst films of 2019.
Indeed it is.
Oh.
It is agony.
When you say the word comedy to describe it, it's because you haven't seen it yet.
That's so depressing because I have to admit, like as I watched the trailer, I was chuckling a little bit. I really enjoyed Kumail's facial expressions and everything. But
they put those jokes. They put the two funny things in the trailer, and then you're done.
Yeah, it is painful to sit through. As Dave likes to point out, this is a movie that can't even get its weather continuity right because for the first 20 minutes, there are constant references to big heat wave in L.A. It's 103 degrees, and then it isn't mentioned.
Sun
again.
Goes down and everyone puts on
and
coats.
Then people are wearing coats, and then at the end of the movie, it's pouring raining. That's just the least of this movie's problems.
There is a good comedy premise involved. You know, the mismatched buddies. One of them is sort of out of his depth. You've seen this film 100 times.
Sensitive, huggy, cryy male versus alpha, shut off feelings, gun-toting guy.
And because that's been done 100 times before, probably more than 100 times, it is up to the filmmakers to give us a little something new, not rely on hacky jokes about masculinity versus femininity in all the things a man can be.
Well, because I was going to say this is being built
electric
as something
car
that's
jokes,
supposed
you know.
To take on toxic masculinity.
No, no, it just embodies it. Yeah. It's not as crazy, like homophobic and terrible as Shaft.
Yes,
but it's trying to be.
It's punching for that weight. This feels like all of the disappointing, forgotten 80s buddy cop movies that followed in the wake of 48 Hours, where Schwarzenegger teams up with Jim Belushi, or where Jim Belushi teams up with John Ritter. Like, I don't even remember the titles of these movies.
Someone teams up with a dog.
I know. Saw them, but I've forgotten them, and I will forget this one.
So are we just hitting that point in the summer where the films are kind of, you know...
It's not August yet.
Oh, yeah. No, but let's pace ourselves, shall we? But in the meantime, hey, if you're in Los Angeles, there's a new 4K reissue of last year at Marienbad opening at the Royal.
That's right. Classic film from Alain Resnais.
Yeah, a French New Wave classic. Set the template for all subsequent parodies of what people who hate art films think that art films are like. It's a black and white film about well-dressed people in a Rococo spa staring into the middle distance and saying enigmatic things.
It's wonderful.
All right. Well, if you are in search of an air-conditioned movie theater, maybe check out that over the...
Everything else.
Over Stuber. All right. Alonzo Duraldi and Dave White review movies for The Wrap and host the movie podcast Linoleum Knife. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you.
That's it for us in Press Play today. Our producers are Alex Trigvedotter, Rosalie Atkinson, Brian Hardzinski, Adriana Cargill, and Caitlin Plummer. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Amy Ta is our digital producer. Mike Stark engineered. Mario Saavedra is our technical director. I'm Michelle Aloy. Madeline Brand will be back Monday. Have a good weekend.